welcome to a brand new episode of Sequel Rights, the podcast where we take a look at the franchises that make you go, wait, they made how many of those? We give each and every sequel a fair trial. My name is Justin Camps, and I'm here with
Elizabeth Helly
and Tyler Hymanson.
And we are here this week talking about 2014's Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. And we have a very special guest with us tonight. Tyler Aquilina is here.
Hello.
Thanks, Tyler. For people who don't know Tyler Aquilina, he is a media analyst for Variety Intelligence Platform.
Yes, that's indeed. Right.
Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk about what I think is a movie that occupies a pivotal place in culture and the history of Hollywood blockbusters at large. So this should be fun.
Incredible.
Absolutely.
Now we've got two Tylers on the podcast tonight, so just, you know, be mindful.
This is what Tyler Hymanson sounds like.
Be mindful of right when you say, Tyler, what do you think about that? Who are you talking to? Okay.
Right.
We always defer to the guest here, so it's
that's
fine.
That's right. Guest first.
Or you could just point at me.
That's right.
Yeah. I
mean, like the Apes movies, we can make use of
that. Oh, right. Yeah. Oh,
yeah, I don't know sign language, unfortunately.
Home.
Neither do I.
Yeah. Neither does James Franco.
Trying to watch this movie with the subtitle track accidentally turned off is very difficult.
Yes.
Like, wow, what are they doing?
When I watched it with my roommate on Hulu, and if you have subtitles on, it doubles the subtitles. So I had to double turn them off. I was like, ugh.
Double subs.
That's anyway. Double sub.
All right. Well, before we get too far into things, Eliz, where can people reach out?
Yes, we're actually rapidly coming to the close of this franchise, so let us know what we should cover next by emailing us, sequelrights@gmail.com, or messaging us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Sequel Rights. We also have every episode ever on YouTube, which is youtube.com/@sequelrights.
And rate and review us wherever you're listening to. If you feed stars into the algorithm, it will make our podcast more popular. So please do that. Leave comments on the YouTube. And I had a question that I had asked people to put in the comments of the YouTube channel. I don't remember what it was. And I don't know if we've got any responses. So we'll follow up on that next week.
Next time on the podcast. All right. Well, before we get even further in, like to talk about the movie, Tyler Aquilina, our guest.
Yes.
What's your history with the Planet of the Apes franchise?
It is shamefully brief. I still have not seen.
Get out of here.
I have seen all of the, the reboot films, mm-hmm. except for Kingdom. I have shamefully, it's a shameful hole in my like film going experience. I still have not even seen the 1968 original Planet of the Apes. I've been meaning to get around to for so long. I love the scene in Mad Men where Don takes his kid to see.
Yes. So, it's so good. You were the first person to mention this after our entire, of talking about apes for many, many episodes. And yes, that is a great reference.
Well, you guys don't know me that well, but you can always count on me to drop a Mad Men reference.
Nice.
I saw this movie I don't know if it was an advanced screening. It was like a special screening. I was at USC for the summer. I was doing like a summer program mm-hmm. there. And Matt Reeves, the director, actually came and did a Q&A there.
Oh, cool.
I wish I could remember anything he said during the Q&A. There was like some kind of thing where like the RAs were like mad at us for being out too late, even though we were at like a school sanctioned event. So I don't know what the deal with that was. But,
if you don't remember a question, do you remember, was it Funny Hat Matt Reeves or Bow Tie Matt Reeves?
I want to say it was Bow Tie Matt Reeves. I didn't realize there were like two Matt
There's
Reeves.
There's two bespoke Matt Reeves, yeah.
Wait, speaking of Mad Men and USC screenings, when I was in school for a class, Vincent Kartheiser from Mad mm-hmm. Men came and talked after we watched the episode of Mad Men, and mm-hmm. he was so drunk and or high and or something that like the professor actually like kind of got pissed. Like, this guy could like not coherently answer questions. It was hilarious.
He was just there for, it was inebriated on the campus ambience.
Yeah, maybe.
The men are in mad keeping with the show.
Yeah.
which episode was it?
Yeah. I have no idea.
Oh, man.
I think it was the, I don't know. It was many years
was
ago.
Was Don swimming laps yet?
Yeah. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
That's great. Love it. Love Matt Reeves. Why don't we dive on in to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
Do not want war. makes him stronger.
We both have families. You want to protect yours. I want to protect mine. It's our only chance for peace.
Are you aware?
No!
They are going to turn on you.
They're animals!
Caesar, it's your home.
Who was that?
A good man like you.
Caesar, love humans more than apes.
If you threaten his family, he will retaliate.
Don't shoot!
Woo!
So...
It sounded pretty serious here.
I was going to say, immediately this gets at something so interesting about the movie, which is that if you take out all the talk about apes from that trailer, it sounds like it could be the trailer for like Zero Dark Thirty or something.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Which is fascinating.
Yes.
This movie, it really... Can I get it? Start getting into the
yes,
petty
so absolutely. Do not go in any order, please.
It belongs to really like this like post Dark Knight school of filmmaking, where it's like we need all our blockbusters to be very serious and very very quote unquote grounded and realistic, even if they're dealing with talking monkeys, you know. So it really like. This movie it kind of organizes itself around this, just like this very serious, these very serious ideas, these very big ideas. Reeves really would kind of continue to hone that in his next movie in the franchise, which basically almost turns into a Holocaust movie starring apes.
Yeah.
Which I find fascinating.
Yes. Yeah. I think that the thing that I always describe this movie as is it's from a post-production background, it is this kind of watershed moment where it feels like this smaller, intimate movie where there's scenes where it's just like two people in a room or, you know, it feels like it's this John Carpenter movie that just so happens to have multi-million-dollar wet effects inside of it. And to me, that is one of the coolest things ever. This is probably in my top 10 favorite movies of all time.
What?
Like as we're really talking good. About it's things, really it is kind of a pinnacle of where motion cap technology comes in and where we're trying to do that on set for the first time. And I think that there are some things and some effects that in this movie will never be done better just because of the way that things are moving in the industry. And I think that there are so many amazing things to talk about. I understand why you chose that trailer, but I remember the teaser trailer, which is the one that was on Hulu before this. If this is where most of us watched it. I remember seeing it so many times in the theater, and it's the one that had like one or two bits, but it just started with, you know, the close-up of Caesar's eyes. And then at the beginning of the movie, with the slow pan out, and they're all in war paint, and then him, you know, initiating the hunt at the beginning.
Yeah.
And I find that such a compelling piece of cinema that's so ballsy at that time of just like, we're going to start at a like, hey, remember Polar Express wasn't that long ago. we're going to close up on the eyes and then zoom out. And it's just incredible. And also not possible unless you fire the goddamn money gun at this thing, which they did. And I'm happy about it.
Yeah. This movie was crazy expensive.
Yes, it was.
And it's interesting too that, you know, you touched on this point about how intimate it is.
Mm-hmm.
I was shocked rewatching it because I hadn't seen this movie since it came out like about 10 years ago. Like there's the action doesn't kick in until like shockingly late in the movie, considering how much money this movie cost and how it was positioned as this huge thing.
This giant blockbuster temple movie where it's like 2 hours of like quiet conversations and like building of family dynamics.
Well, and there was like, when the movie came out, there was tons of articles and dialogue around how like there's no spoken words for the first like 20 minutes or something in the movie. Lots of hand signals and sign language.
That was a big thing that people like to talk about back
then. Let me
that was a huge deal.
Let me mention a little movie you might have heard of called WALL-E.
But that's for kids. That's a cartoon for kids.
How dare you?
Not a real movie.
And it has a jaunty Broadway tune. So
true. Jaunty Broadway tunes. That's accurate.
It's another interesting thing though about especially how this movie starts, like as you said,
Right.
It's a long stretch, like no, you know, spoken dialogue. The apes are all like signing at each other. I remember that was fascinating. And we should jump back at some point and talk about like the very beginning of this movie.
Yeah, because there's credits, right?
Yes.
Like Obama comes to tell
us. Yeah, no, the very beginning of this movie is harder to watch now.
Yes, I can't believe it.
I thought it was kind of like intense and somber then, and now it's like really, it's too real.
Yeah.
It's too real.
Well, it's like, it's one of the things where there's a point of it where, and the, sorry to be a bummer, but I did look this up where it was like, oh, like we predict this, you know, virus pandemic's going to kill 5 million to 150 million people. And I was like, well, like, what did we just go through? And it's like, okay, so COVID killed 7 million.
Yeah.
Cool. So, like, we just went through, like, this.
Yeah.
This. I thought, all I could think about the whole time was like, oh, it probably would have been a lot easier for them to pull sound bites for this fake, you know, pandemic that was happening.
Yeah, the guy literally says, like, if you have a cough, sore throat, it's like, stay home. And
they,
I was just
they
like,
essentially use clips of Obama, who was probably talking about, like, earthquake safety or something. And they make it sound like he's talking about, you know, make sure you have a plan for your family. Homes, yeah.
How to deal with the simian flu.
Simian flu.
It's really messed up, too, that they call it the simian flu because it does not come from the apes at all. It only comes from the original virus that James Franco created.
If there's one thing humans are known at being great at, it's naming diseases.
Well, even that, it's like it was created in a lab. Like, it's not even from them.
Yeah.
like, that's a line in this movie.
Yep.
Yeah.
So that's aged well.
It was just like they nailed it. Yeah. 10 out of 10, no notes.
Well, it's very interesting, though, because they do take the time to specifically say, like, there has been no, like, the apes didn't kill anybody or fight anyone yet, really.
Yes.
Like, it was all the humans that killed each other and left themselves in such a sorry state that now the apes are.
It's a really cool, like, concept of that. Like, it's been 10 years. The apes are just like, we haven't even thought about humans. Like, it looks like they're gone.
It's also like totally unclear what the humans fully even know about the apes.
Yes, they know the Golden Gate Bridge happened.
Right, but they don't seem to know that one of them could talk, or maybe that they were like hyper super intelligent.
Yeah.
It just seems like a very weird thing that like people probably saw in the news and was like, well, that was weird, and then they never thought
about it
again.
A bunch of apes escaped into the woods.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's like that's the Pasadena parrots or something. Right. Yeah.
If the parrots were suddenly like, get off my lawn! You'd be like, fuck! That parrot just
Maybe they will be.
It was pretty crazy, though, because, just going into it, I barely remembered, because, like I said, I watched this, like, in the middle of the night before I went to go see Dawn, or not Dawn, the next one.
War.
With you. And so I didn't really remember, but I was like, is this going to be like all the apes from other parts of the world like came and joined up with them? Or like, what's the deal going to be? Like, you know, how are they going to...
The Ape UN.
Yeah, but they do have a really cool like city setup.
The production design for this movie is... I was going to say bananas, but I stopped myself.
It is
incredible. That entire Apes Village is a gigantic practical set that James Chinlin built. It is one of the last big sets for a good long while. Like it looks striking. It looks incredible. It's very cool.
It's awesome. Like that scene too, when like Jason Isaacs' character, like finally comes back and walks through that like gate. And that
Jason Clark, not Jason.
Jason Clark.
There's a way different movie.
Isaacs. Jason Clark comes back.
This has nothing to do with The Cure for Wellness.
Good point. I'm talking about that place where there's like a gauntlet and it's like all these like, you know, pieces of wood and everything. It's cool.
And the whole conception of the ape society, I think. The easy joke to make about this movie is like, why did they call it Dawn of the Planet of the Apes when they already had the Rise of the Planet of the Apes? Like Dawn before the sun dawns before it rises. But watching it this time, I think I can mount a half-hearted defense of a kind of a dumb title, which is that.
Yes.
Like, so the last movie had this actual uprising, and then this is about like the dawn of like the actual society that will form on the Planet of the Apes. He said, not having actually seen the Planet of the Apes. So I don't know how much of that actually like kind of is like planting the seed of stuff that you'll see.
Surprisingly well. Yeah. I mean, like, I think that there's a moment in this movie at the end. Like, I think that it is to piggyback off of your Dark Knight thesis, it is we live in a society movie.
Yes, very much so.
And that is the starting of that, of like Caesar recognizing those dynamics, recognizing that it can't just be this tribal family where like we're all looking out for each other, that it's this more political, inevitable thing. And it's like his journey of learning that. and how inevitable destruction comes from those types of things. And it's a really heartbreaking movie because of that.
I thought my whole thing, like when I was watching this movie, I thought it was like really fascinating to, you know, now having seen all of the old films,
yeah,
to like reflect and think about like what they're pulling from the original franchise. Like for me, this movie is almost like a remake of Battle, but if it was done like really well,
yeah,
it's like got a lot of the same elements where you're like talking about apes don't kill apes. And mm-hmm. there's kind of like a, you know, kind of warring factions within the ape society. And you've got Caesar and he's got a son. It's like a lot of the same things. There's like human colony that they're going to go deal with.
By the way, just a quick bone to pick while we're on Battle.
Yeah.
When we did Battle, I specifically said, I think I remember in Dawn of the Planet of the Apes, there's like a pivotal bus. And you guys were like, nah, no bus. there's no bus. What are you talking about? There's a bus.
There's a pivotal bus.
There's a pivotal bus. Yeah, I was right.
You're right. You're right.
There was anyway. A bus. But
this has been our correction section.
Yes, thank you. When they were in the shipyard, I was like, this is what the shipyard battle that was promised to us in Conquest that was really sad. And it was just two people running around an abandoned ship. This is like for real, the cool stuff you can do in an abandoned shipyard.
I think that all of that's true. And I also think that it's doing this extension because like your thesis is correct that like this is in 2014 when we all have to have serious blockbusters. But the first film is, you know, pretty damn serious as well.
This is a different level.
Yes, it is. It is.
The first one's, I mean, you could see it in the visuals of it too. Like the first one is very like sunlit and kind of fun.
No, I mean the original 60s Planet of the Apes.
Okay.
Where I think the thing that captures everyone's imagination there is, you know, the inevitability of like self-destruction, annihilation of the species, right? And I think that this movie kind of says like, okay, yeah, that's an idea that we, you know, it's been around for 50 years at this point. Like, what does that mean? Like, how does that happen? What is, you know, why is it inevitable? And I think that this movie really drills down into, you know, the interesting human emotional reasons for that. And it is so much more heartbreaking because of that. And it feels so much more true and real. Like, this movie feels like,
it is a movie about like the worst parts of humanity and how that can infect even, you know, groups that try to live by the best ideals of humanity in a way.
It really is like, it's not even quite post-apocalyptic. It's like mid-apocalyptic. We've seen so many like reasons. I literally just finished watching Fallout and I was listening to other podcasts where they were talking about this. But like the reason we didn't all come together in the real pandemic is because it didn't get bad enough, actually. What we're seeing in these movies or whatever, like Last of Us or whatever, where things have gone way farther. This is like, things went pretty bad, but these humans in this movie are like soft as hell. It's like they're trying to get electricity and communication. I'm like, you don't need that. Like when the speech that was in the trailer of the guy being like, the scariest thing about them is that they don't need the electricity. They don't need that. And I'm like, I was yelling at the TV, like, neither do you. Like, should you need
the 76 gas station?
Right. Like, can you just survive? Like, you guys aren't even that bad off. You're like worrying about trying to get electricity. Like, worry about farming. I don't know. Like,
I mean, I'm going to use very highfalutin terminology, please. But it's the Promethean sin of humanity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They need electricity. They're trying to like rebuild something resembling modern society.
Well, yeah, because it's only 10 years, so they're not far enough out that they're like, they're still trying to grasp on to what they can remember from the good old days or whatever.
Yeah.
So, kind of makes sense.
Yeah.
That's another thing I like about this movie, because we kind of talked about how it was a little bit weird in Battle to go from like Conquest to Battle and like, oh, the apes already all talk, they got clothes. It's just like the Planet of the Apes. This one feels like more of like that middle ground where it's like, they talk sometimes and you can tell that like some of them can talk, but not all of them. And they're not just spouting off full sentences super easily.
Yeah.
It's like a struggle. And it also, I like the fact that it's kind of a struggle for them to talk, because it adds like, feels like it adds extra weight to everything they say, because they're talking so slowly and every word has to have the meaning because it takes so much, you know, energy for them to speak.
Speech from the oppressed is, you know, a big thing in the first movie. And I think that keeping that weight going forward, like Koba doesn't speak until
or Maurice,
yeah, like Hoba, but like Hoba's the first other ape that we hear, like,
yeah, for a lot of the movie I thought maybe only Caesar could still talk, and then I was like, okay, Hoba was also dosed like multiple times, but then this goes to prove your theory from the last episode that it's not the dosing that made them able to talk, it was like the dosing and then the learning,
right,
because obviously the next generation and then Maurice has picked it up.
But
and,
but like for Hoba, you know, like his line of human work and like pointing to the scars in his body, human work, like Matt Reeves has delayed that, like it is such an impactful, you feel that it takes effort. Like there's so much storytelling and world building just in the delivery of that line that is, I'm going to nerd out about this.
Well, and it's going to take a while because like, this is another thing that we were saying last week. It's like, you know, 90 to 95% of the apes in the colony are dumb. Like they were never dosed with the thing, you know? So they either have to breed with someone who was or just evolve and adapt. So.
I have so many questions about how their society works. I kind of wish the movie spent more time on that.
Like,
in my memory of this movie, that opening section, like before the humans come in, was a lot longer. It's really only like 10, 15 minutes by my count. And they get the plot going pretty quickly, which is too bad, honestly, because I do feel like the movie dips a little
bit. Well, and I was just looking at the runtime for Kingdom. It's 20 minutes longer than this movie.
What?
And yes, it is. And it's like, this movie is 2:10. Which I think is a fine run time, but like
I think it's too long.
Yeah, I agree. But also there are you're saying that opening time. You know, I think that if this movie came out today, there'd be 20 more minutes at the ape colony at the beginning.
Right, and I you know,
and it would still be too long. I don't disagree with you.
I just think
I didn't think it was too long. Sorry.
Maybe the runtime is just like misplaced a little bit. Because as I say, I could have had a longer opening and maybe a little bit less of the stuff we get later.
Right.
But I do.
Damn work.
I would love to know, like, in the development of this movie, like, how many conversations were had about, like, how much time can we spend with the apes, like, by themselves? Mm-hmm. Because it does feel like Reeves is kind of, like, pushing, like, how much can the apes, like, carry, and the mocap, especially, like, carry the movie by themselves? Like, obviously, he would push that a lot further in war, and I think... Honestly, you were saying this is one of your like favorite movies maybe ever.
Right.
This is my least favorite of the three, honestly, because I just think that you can feel him kind of pushing towards things that he would really like come to full flower
in war. Yeah.
And in this one, he's kind of working out the kinks a little
bit. Yeah, yeah. I think that's right, but I think that the ambition of it, and I like the story, and I think that it has the bones of like that 60s sci-fi, like it feel like this one feel I like the scale of this one, and I think that the gross wasting of resources to make a movie at this scale is incredible to me.
$170 million dollars.
I mean, listen, those render farms do not come cheap. I'm curious to you know, what you guys think of the fact that, like, as I was saying, this is very much a part of what I might call like the kind of the grimdark blockbuster phase. This movie came out in 2014. That was really a pivotal year in the like Hollywood history, because what was the biggest movie of that summer? It was Guardians of the Galaxy. And hard to recall now, but there was a time before that movie came out when people were like, I don't know, is this going to be like the thing that's just too far for Marvel?
Weird.
Like,
it's going to be
talking,
too weird.
Talking raccoon, walking talking tree. Like, are people going to be into that?
Yeah.
And then when that movie was such a success, it was officially like, okay, Marvel can turn anything into a hit.
Right.
Like, people will show up for everything. And then that really kind of moved the chains on like, okay, we can get back to sort of like goofier, funnier blockbusters now. We can get away from this kind of very serious milieu, if you will, that has kind of defined blockbuster filmmaking for the last several years. So that's honestly
you're talking about Superman letting his dad die.
Superman snapping somebody's neck.
Yeah,
all that kind of stuff. I mean, this movie feels very much of that school. Man of Steel was just the year before.
But done so much
better. It really was.
So much better.
Well, that's the thing. It's like it plays better now, maybe, than it even did at the time. Mm-hmm. Because I think the self-seriousness sort of suits the movie because of this whole like idea of hard sci-fi and all the kind of concepts that it's juggling, like, fit really well into that. And honestly, Matt Reeves is still kind of carrying the torch for that, like, kind of like grimdark, serious blockbuster filmmaking and doing it pretty well. I mean, I was just rewatching part of the Batman before this, and it's like, that movie does pretty well with
also
that.
Also ends at dawn.
You're right.
Yeah. That is true.
They drive off.
Hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, and then War, I think by the time you get to War, like, that movie felt a little out of place in the cultural landscape because it was still like sort of not stuck, but like playing in this kind of sandbox of like the very serious grounded blockbuster in a way. So that's my theory about where this movie fits into the kind of the pop cultural development.
Absolutely.
Speaking of pop culture, was the kid in this movie wearing a Game of Thrones t-shirt?
Was he? I didn't even notice that.
Cody Smith.
Yeah, I don't know. I thought he was wearing like a Winterfell shirt.
He was reading
some, tell us about this graphic novel.
Okay, so he's reading Black Hole.
And my roommate was like, that graphic novel sucks.
Okay, so this is it was a big like popular graphic novel back in the day. Okay. Daniel Close. It's horny as hell. So when he was giving it to that, like, it's like, so
to Maurice. Yeah.
So when he's giving it to Maurice, I was like, don't give him that.
So there are actually like keggers involved in this graphic novel?
Yes, okay. Yes. Mm. So basically it's a graphic novel about a STD that causes mutations in teens. So like, whoa, if you have sex, like that you can have, and some of the mutations are like cool, and some of the mutations are like horribly grotesque and weird and off-putting. Mm. I haven't read it since college, but like, it's one of those things that was ever present at that time.
Okay.
I feel like it would have been cool to see that part of it in the movie instead of just having it being like missing.
And the keggers.
This kegger, like, hanging out.
Yeah. Yeah, and I was like, ooh, that's a weird thing to explain to a monkey.
I feel like the apes would have related to like the mutations.
Yeah.
Perhaps. what else can we talk about?
Okay, so the human people. Yes, Cody Smith McPhee is the only credited kid in this movie. I have nothing to tell you to check in with him on.
Well,
he Paranormand, and then he just showed us all the power of the dog.
Wasn't he in Let Me In? Was he the boy?
Yeah, he was. Yeah. So
that's Matt Reeves had previously worked with him.
That's yes.
I wanted to find like Child on Shoulder and Dance Party, but he's not credited anymore.
There's a lot of returning Matt Reeves all-stars in this movie.
Yeah. We've got Gary Oldman, Carrie Russell, mm-hmm. Jason Clarke.
Not enough Carrie Russell.
Never enough Carrie Russell. Unless you're watching The Ambassador.
Well, is this mid-Americans or like pre-Americans?
I think this is like right around the time America.
I think maybe the first season.
That started like 2013, I want to say.
Maybe. But anyways, I feel like society didn't like fully appreciate everything she could do yet because more, she's not in this movie enough.
It's more Carrie Russell than Mission Impossible 3. But.
Right, sure. And more than Star Wars.
Yeah.
If you remember that Carrie Russell was in a Star Wars.
Yeah.
But,
oh, wow. I totally forgot.
I know. I try to forget.
Her face is in it for 2 seconds.
Yeah. Anyway, but yeah, she's there. Jason Clarke, who, I don't know, was the last thing I saw him in. I think he had sex with Helen Mirren a whole bunch. The Russian Catherine the Great on HBO.
Well,
it was a period.
Well, he was in Oppenheimer. So.
Right, yeah. But he was like the dumbass in Oppenheimer, wasn't he?
I don't even remember. There's too many.
Is he the guy who got owned by Emily Blunt?
Too many white dudes.
Yeah.
Right. Anyway, yeah. Another white guy in Oppenheimer.
This was during his 15 minutes when he was like all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But okay. Obviously, then we have Andy Serkis back, who is still just like incredible.
I mean, the things he's able to do just with like standing up straight. And, I mean, like, it's great because like Caesar, you know, doesn't talk a ton of lines in this film,
yeah,
but his presence is felt so strongly.
I was saying, just as I was telling my girlfriend, I was just watching this, like, it's annoying that like in 20 years or in like a decade, we're gonna have to watch, like, he's gonna get his honorary Oscar and that'll be cool, but like he deserves it.
Well, this was the movie when the Oscar buzz for him like started to really,
yes,
or like, at least the people saying like he should be nominated. That was when that really started to pick up, and people were like, "This is like real acting, real performance."
Yes. Oh yeah,
which I agree. I mean, his face and his facial expressions have to carry so much weight
Everything.
In this movie,
yeah,
and it really does not work if that stuff is not selling.
And the voice,
yeah.
So
and the level of, you know, like, yeah, he was great in Rise, but this is like a whole nother level.
The emotional gymnastics that he's trying to go through. It's like, hey, so you need to communicate the entire tragedy of lucidity and understanding and having a society on your face right now, and then go beat somebody up on a skyscraper, please.
You know, I would say my big criticism of this movie is almost that, like, they don't rely on that enough. Like, I think that, you know, he does a good job carrying, like, the arc of, like, okay, so I'm burdened with leadership and I have to figure out, like, what it is to be a leader in a time of crisis. I feel like the whole, like, kind of false flag operation where, like, you know, Koba, like, tries to kill him and then it's like, oh, the humans murdered Caesar, like, that whole thing. That's where the movie starts to, like, really lose me a little bit, just because that plot turn just feels, like, kind of overdone. Fake out deaths are also one of my biggest pet peeves. I have
the fact they didn't look for him.
They didn't
go look
for him. Right. Yeah. They also let the whole colony burn down super fast. And I'm like, if they had all this fire for this long, there's no way that no one ever spilled a torch before this. Sure. Like they should have an emergency, you know, fire system. Fire
we're talking about irrigation.
Well, not even irrigation, but they should have a plan and like dirt and, you know,
Yeah, they probably should have.
I think the thing that gives me the buy-in on it is that Caesar truly believed that he didn't have to,
because they were all good.
He didn't have to apes are defend different. His flank. Yeah, yeah. Like they're different and that they're good. But Koba had that evil, you know, instilled in him, and the way that he was treated.
It sort of ruins it though that they already had the rule "ape shall not kill ape," because it's like, what made him come up with that rule before this?
I mean,
he didn't. It was just him. Like, he wanted to kill him in that moment, and he was just like, you know what? I'm not going. Like,
No. I know. But in the beginning of the movie, we see that Maurice is teaching them like the rules, and they already have rule number one: ape shall not kill ape.
Yeah, but I think it's because they already kind of discussed.
I mean, that's like rule one for a society,
yeah. Right?
Well, they discuss in the film that like humans destroyed each other, whatever, and so they so they have this whole feeling of like, we're better than humans. We're going to be better. We don't. The issue with humans is that they kill each other. Right.
Yeah.
We don't do that.
Right. Yeah. I do feel like if I were a super intelligent ape creating an ape society out in the woods, my first rule to differentiate from humankind would be like, okay, they kill each other. We're not going to do that.
Yeah.
But that feels like a logical starting point.
Yeah. I like the stuff with Koba and like his betrayal and everything, because I personally enjoy, you know, yes, we have like these new human characters and Gary Oldman being, you know, like bad, but also kind of relatable at the same time out of nowhere. But I really like that. Like, I feel like we see so many of these franchises where it'll just be like, oh, we've got Caesar, but also now there's all these new random apes that we don't know. And there's an evil ape that came out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And I love that it's like,
It's Koba.
We've still got Rocket. Yes. Yeah. We've got like some kids, but it's like the kid of Rocket and the kid of Caesar. So it's like, we're working with characters we already know. And
if you're going to throw in a random ape in there, it better be played by Steve Zahn.
That's right. Exactly. It's like that off the bat is like a step up above from so many sequels that we saw.
I was like, I watched this whole movie and I was absolutely floored. Like when the credits that
Judy Koba, Greer.
Judy Greer. Yeah. But that Koba was Toby Kebbell, because I just barely finished watching however many seasons of fucking Servant on Apple TV Plus. Yeah. And he is literally the worst, which now I'm like, maybe he's a genius because I just thought he was a horrible piece of shit the entire time. So I was like, he was acting like a piece of shit, but maybe he's actually cool because Koba, like this performance as Koba is really, really good. I guess maybe like the best performance.
That Koba sequence is like seared into my brain where he gets the gun from the two.
It's hilarious.
That's one of the top
scenes. We've never seen anyone do anything like that in any of these apes movies yet, because the apes were already like, everyone knew that they were smart. This is the first time where somebody could be like, could get you over on one. Like,
yeah, it's definitely like the most chilling sequence out of the whole thing, I think. Cause just the way that like those guys are totally, I was like, what can I even take clips from? There's like nothing funny in this movie. It's like so serious.
Yeah. Right.
It was the only part that I was like, oh, this is kind of funny. Okay. When they're like,
what the hell's wrong with you? I thought we told you to go out.
I love it. They're just like yelling at him.
Yeah.
And he's like,
no.
I mean, it's not even.
Don't say no.
So I think that maybe this is a good time to talk a little bit about like the insanity of how this movie was made, right? So Terry Notary is there. Most of this is shot in person, and they just shot it with the mocap, and then someone had to roto every goddamn time. Ape on a horse, roto. Reflections in the water, roto. Like they shot everything there, but this sequence was really just three people, you know, interacting. They shot most of it with him. They did some clean plate without him, so it's just the actors reacting. And it kind of has this layering of everything that makes mocap work as a post-production tool, but also all the drawbacks and challenges of that. And it just, like I said earlier, you have to fire the money gun at this shit, but I do think that you get the reason that scene works and is so memorable is the reactions that you get from those actors. And you can tell that like it is all about that interactivity. Like, I don't think it's a scene that works with traditional animation if it's not mocap with an actor there in place and all that working. And the cost of that is extremely high, but I think that it is an incredible sequence.
Well, yeah, because you don't get to see there's that one feels the most like, just because he's like sitting there and like they're having fun for a second, yeah. It feels like, oh man, yeah, that Koba's like totally right there. There's a bunch of other scenes with, you know, the humans that are up at the dam and whatever, but they're all kind of like very, you know, standing around doing talking or whatever. So this is the one where it's like, feels like they're hanging out, they're buds. And then, you know, obviously things take a turn, but it's just like, it's cool the way you're describing how they put together.
It is every tool in the tool chest. It's every technique and it's done masterfully.
It works.
Yeah.
Well, again, it feels like a proof of concept for like what a lot of the stuff you would do in war. It's just like blending these two worlds together and making it feel all of a piece. Like, and I kind of wish more of the movie were like that. Mm-hmm. It is just kind of a nicely contained set piece that functions very well and kind of brings all the elements of the movie together in this really cool way. Also, like, not for nothing, just kind of a perfect, you know, one scene encapsulation of like the themes of the movie.
Yeah.
In a way, it's like, oh, he gets the gun and what does he do? He's, you know, immediately starts killing people. Yep. You know, this is the second time I'll reference Prometheus, but it's like the kind of Promethean fire that the apes get is like guns that allow them to start, you know, acting more like humans and waging war and all
Michael
this stuff.
Fassbender should be in this. You're right.
Okay. I'm realizing now that's a reference to the movie Prometheus. But, rather than the classical myth that I'm trying to invoke. But yeah, no, I find all that stuff fascinating. And then and the action sequences in this movie also very well done.
Yeah.
Reeves is so also very good at what my friend likes to call splash pages, which is just these kind of single image that you could like put on a comic book on like one of those big, huge two page spreads. You get a lot of those in the Batman, obviously.
Yes.
The one here that really comes to mind is like when the apes are like marching all the people out and you get that ape like sitting on the flagpole with the American flag.
Oh, or it's Koba like riding through the fire with the double guns. Yeah. It's like, that's almost straight out of the Batman of him coming through the flames too. Yeah. And I'm like,
absolutely.
Do it every movie, Matt Reeves.
he's very good at taking advantage of the big canvas that he gets in a way that not every blockbuster filmmaker
absolutely
is.
It is funny that we were talking about in the last film the symbol of the stained glass window, and we're like, it almost reminds us of the Fireflies.
Yep.
And I forgot that that's a thing that happens in this movie.
Yeah, it comes back.
Yeah,
I know, that's a good, like, you know, sequel thing to talk about.
Some
direct references to The Rise of the Planet of the Apes. I almost said the original film, but Rise of the Planet of the Apes this time.
And I feel like done incredibly tastefully well.
Yeah.
Like going back to the house, although if power is a big thing, if Gary Oldman's looking at his family for the first time on the iPad, that mini DV cam recorder, that, like, Sony makes a hell of a battery, I guess. But,
well, you know.
No one's turned it on for 10 years.
Power extended there too?
Sure.
From the dam?
Maybe. Oh, yeah, maybe.
Yeah, okay. I don't know. That's
like. But again, like, that bullshit doesn't matter. I'm just making a joke. But no, I think it's cool that they need a safe place to go. That's where they go. And
I'm sure they just, like, I don't know, like, they didn't want to do it. But it would have been so bad if, like, elderly James Franco or something had been there being like Caesar, you know,
like he was hiding there.
Yeah, or something, or anything. Yeah, but
like his bones are just there.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, we don't even see like a tape of him being like, if you ever come see this, I died from the virus or whatever.
I love it. Like,
forget it. Yeah. He's gone. He's not here.
Yeah, talk about tasteful and respectful. James Franco's only in this movie for like 5 seconds. As little as we could possibly use of him.
And probably B-roll from the previous film.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that kind of like, you know, nostalgic return trip to the house there. It adds like extra, like I don't think I ever got to the point where I was like, oh, he's actually going to die in this one or anything. Mm. But like, it adds extra weight to, like, you know, him thinking maybe he's about to die and like reflecting on his life and
it's heading
the connection with humans.
It's also putting him back to a place of innocence of like, like that this was not complicated. This was not things that were thrust upon me. And then, okay, I have to make this choice. Like, I think that there is something really insane about this movie that is not, you know, of how much Batman we're talking about around this movie is also very funny. Where it's sandwiched between two Batmans, the Batman and the Dark Knight.
And we've got Gary Oldman.
And Gary Oldman as well. is when, he, the, you know.
Don't forget Batfleck, by the way. Yeah. Just 2 years after this movie.
Yep. Yeah, Caesar's mother's name was also Martha.
Oh my God! No, it wasn't. It was Bright Eyes.
Martha.
You know, his choice to like, I love in this movie. There's a few moments that I think that are like big sci-fi, like metaphor ideas. And I think one of them is his choice to kill Koba. And I think that like there's the weight of. He doesn't want to do it. He doesn't believe in it, but he knows he can't lead. You know, he takes that moment to look around and be like, okay, I have to, like, I need to gain power, and I will do this in order to do that. And I think that the fact that that is clear and that scene works is fucking crazy.
Well, the fact that it was getting to that point and I was like, oh, he's not going to kill Koba. He's going to do the Disney villain thing where he extends his hand and then Koba tries to hit him and then he falls to his death or whatever. Yeah. But then I was like, when he actually did it, I was like, no, he really did it. And I think that's what happened in Battle also.
That's what I'm saying.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. It was the same stuff.
Similar to Battle because it's the two guys up in the tree and this is like the first death, you know, sin.
This is the official
Caesar,
Caesar's going to kill this guy.
Yeah.
Because he, well, you know, and it's, it went even further and Koba does kill Ash.
Yeah. That was crazy.
Koba doesn't kill Caesar's son in this one, but Koba kills Rocket's son.
Yeah. And again, like the things you take for granted in this movie, the fact that two CG characters dragging one of them up the stairs and then throwing them over a balcony to murder them elicits gasps and like deep emotion is not something that an executive, when they approved this movie, believed would be possible.
And it's so emotional when Blue Eyes tells Caesar about it happening.
Yes.
Because in the moment, he's like so shocked that but when he has to explain to Caesar what happened and he starts crying, it's so it's like that's a human teenager kid crying. It doesn't look like, I don't think we've seen any of them like come to tears like that until this, but just about that next generation, because I was kind of like, how old are these like kids supposed to be? So I was like looking it up because they seem the same size pretty much as the adults. They don't seem that much smaller. So I guess chimps get to the adult size by the time they are 9 or 10, which would make sense,
right?
For this, 10 years have passed.
Oh wow, but, it takes that long.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, but to be full-sized, but then they don't really, like, they're not, they're barely starting, like, puberty, even though they are the same size at this point. So he wouldn't be, like, you know, going for the lady apes or trying to, like, have kids yet or anything like that. So he's essentially, like, a 12 or 13-year-old in our human society speak, which is pretty crazy because they do have him out there, like, doing, you know, crazy stuff. He's
fighting a bear.
He's then got to lead the resistance to the resistance in order to, you know, defeat Koba or whatever. But, yeah, these are actually, like, really young kids. So Koba killed like a 12-year-old kid that hasn't got through puberty yet in front of everybody, which is just insane.
I think the actor Nick Thurston and, like, you know, obviously the animators and everything that goes into Blue Eyes, I think they did a great job of like conveying he's kind of got these wide eyes. Like there's so many scenes where you see him just kind of like looking on like what's happening, and you get a real sense of like he's just kind of going with the flow and that naivete and doesn't really know what's happening. I agree. That scene.
You're going to play the soul of a society, child.
Yeah. Like, oh, wow. Yeah. He was not prepared for that.
And then even when you realize you've done wrong, it's too late.
So let me hit you with this. Yeah. So I like everything you're saying. And again, I think there's a lot of great ideas in this movie.
Yeah.
Very compelling stuff about, like, you know, oppressed people becoming oppressors and things like that. In this whole crisis around leadership. Do you not think it would be just like a little bit stronger if, like, you got more of a sense of Koba kind of fomenting like dissent within the ape society? Mm. If like there was like, you know, other apes who were more skeptical of like trusting humans, because it's like, you know, there's that whole conversation between Caesar and Maurice the orangutan early on, where Maurice is like, well, I only knew humans' bad side. I didn't know them like you. I didn't see their goodness. And I feel like that thread kind of ends up going a little unexplored, because again, Koba's very representative of like, I only knew the bad side of humans, and I think that there are other apes who would probably like feel that way, and he could like rally them to his cause, and there could be like a real like ideological split like within the ape community, which sounds like such a crazy thing to say, I realize.
All the ones who are smart enough to even be thinking on that level politically are all loyal to Caesar, because he freed
there
them.
Are some other
Koba apes. Kind of freed he kind of freed Koba, but not in the same way he freed the people that were
the terrifying reality of this is that they feel attacked and they feel scared. Mm-hmm. And the like humans were not something they thought about for 10 years.
Right.
And the fact that it's like these people are coming to kill your children and take your home. The quickness of people being like, yep, like I'm going to go with that person right. is historically true.
Well, and Koba, even in the last film, already was kind of like,
yes.
Caesar had to be like, no, don't kill yeah. that dude. Right, right, stop right. this.
Yeah. Well, Rocket in the beginning.
He did. He does, yes.
Rocket is sort of like, I don't know, Koba sounds pretty good. I like what he's saying, but fuck no, I'm not betraying Caesar. Like, well, Caesar's everything to me.
Like, this movie has a thing where Rocket's son was shot by these people and he saves that guy.
Yeah.
Like it is, they're demonstrating them being better. Yeah. And it is how fragile that is. Right. And I think that I agree with you. Like that's a thing that I think feels more true, but I think that there's something chilling about how it's like, nope, mob mentality. Like we're going to go to war and kill everybody.
Yeah. I just think there's a big difference between like, I was already smart and Caesar let me out of my cage.
True.
As opposed to I was dumb. I was abused by Draco Malfoy
yeah.
and Caesar made me smart and let me out of my cage. Like that's going to make even more loyalty. Yeah. You know, yeah. Than,
yeah. 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 But I like to go back to Rocket saving them. Like it's one of those things that's just so it makes what happens so emotionally more devastating to me.
Yeah.
So you're talking about Rocket saving the humans, or
yeah, Rocket when the dam implosion, in the, yeah. he saves like he excavates Chilean miners the man who shot his son.
Yeah,
that's true. Who then later gets brutally murdered.
Brutally murdered by Koba.
Yep.
Yeah. He, I love it. Like, you sit in the car and you sit in the car for 2 days.
Yeah.
I did love like some of the early sequences, like when the humans first come back in the car and it's like raining. I was like, oh man, this has some great like Jurassic Park.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're like, nobody get out of the car. Do not move. Like, I'm going to go by myself. And I'm like, that. This is like bringing back.
Yeah.
Steven
and that
Spielberg
76 vibes, set, yeah. too, like that practical build yeah. is just incredible.
It's great. Although, how did the foliage grow so fast over the 76 and the road?
10 years?
I don't know. It looked like a lot more than 10. There was no road leading up to it.
It's a forest.
Well, think about...
a lot happens if humans just disappear from the place.
I think about like just how much like nature like started like kind of healing when... You remember the nature is healing?
Yes, yeah,
the
yeah, virus yeah, meme.
Like,
yeah, yeah.
The amount of change that happened just when people weren't driving for like a few months, I feel yeah. like kind of
it was seems like a lot though. But
it's
anyways,
probably accurate.
The gas prices were $6 and $7, which I appreciated.
Which probably seemed astronomically high at the time. And now it's like,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that shell right by the Academy Museum is already above that.
Middle of town, yeah, for sure.
I guess just to return to Tyler's nitpick corner over
here.
Which Tyler? Yeah. Both,
Tyler Aquilina.
I just want to say that just like my other just kind of main criticism of this movie, which is just, again, I think there's a lot of stuff that's done really, really well. Mm-hmm. I just think that there were just like a few things that could have been tweaked mm-hmm. that would have really like taken it over the top. The kind of split between like the ape and human perspective. Mm-hmm. I think it's like a really bold move to like start with the ape perspective and be like fully immersed in this ape world. Mm-hmm. But the way the movie orients itself later, like kind of around the human's perspective, I feel like results in this kind of weirdly bifurcated movie where it's like not fully in the apes or the human's perspective. So it kind of has to juggle.
I think that's
both,
right.
And it doesn't quite pull that off. And I almost feel like, I don't know, for the story that it kind of ultimately ends up telling, like maybe going with the human perspective would have resulted in maybe a slightly stronger dramatically.
I completely agree with you, but I for one love the scene of Jason Clarke retreating into shadow at the end of that. And that works for me. Yeah. And I think that like it is like, oh, here's the balance, like we're gonna make that equal, and it does feel imbalanced. Like it's kind of a less quality movie, it's a less clear movie, but like to have that handoff and be like, okay, yeah, we're fucked. Like,
yeah.
Which I know, but like war doesn't necessarily do that, but just having that shot work. Like I love at the end them just being like, I thought we had a chance.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, I thought we did too.
Yeah, that was good.
That hits pretty hard.
It hits real hard.
When he calls them friends and everything, I was like, oh,
And thinking of that as, if you're thinking of that in the context of they blew it up, you know, we destroyed ourselves, and it's like, that's the moment. It's like, yeah, we destroyed ourselves. Could we have stopped it? I thought we could have, but we can't.
Yeah.
I just feel like maybe that would hit even just a little bit better if you had like a scene where like the humans were kind of, I don't know, reminiscing or like you felt the weight of kind of what they had lost a little bit more. Because I don't know, as it stands, it is juxtaposed with like the kind of the building up of the ape society. Yeah. I feel like the loss of the ape society is really kind of what you end up mourning in this movie of like just this piece.
It's the loss of innocence for them.
Yeah.
I think that I completely agree with that. And something that I really love about this movie and it feels really true is Jason Clarke's character when they are talking about Kara Russell's like, oh, there's like this and the conflict. And he's like, I don't give a shit about any of that. I don't care about any of that at all. Mm. It's like my son saw like some horrible bullshit over the past 10 years. And I'm gonna make sure he never sees anything like that again. And I think that like there is a place for monolithic closed off like motivators in that way that can be good. And like that's, you know, that's this is his Batman, you know, story right there. But I think that I really enjoyed but the movie kind of does deal with that in a weird way where, you know, there's that moment where I forget the character's name, but he's being like, well, don't you hate the apes? Like they infected everybody.
Yeah, you
like,
lost your wife.
You lost your daughter. And like the you know, their kid, their shared child at this point is like, I didn't realize you had a daughter. Yeah. And Kara Russell's like, but I got you and your father. And it's like, that only works if you're like, you're experiencing these people as people who've gone through 10 years of trauma at this point and have gained something from that. And they're already past some of that stuff. But,
and I just feel like that
it feels weird.
It does feel weird. Yeah. And like, it especially feels weird because as Liz, you were saying, like Kara Russell doesn't have very much to do with this movie.
Right. I think that there is something like, she that you're getting CDC at card. Where I don't know that I can put come up with the best suggestion or put my finger on it because I'm obviously not, you know, an amazing screenwriter, but like there's just something off with the balance between the humans and the apes and the human ape relationships and how much time we're getting with everybody. There's just something like slightly off that makes me feel like I'm missing a little bit of what I want. And I, for me, it's easy to say like, it's just that I want more Kara Russell, but there's just something, there's something in the balance between ape and human time and character time that we're getting that is just not quite optimal.
I think that the way that you can pinpoint that is it's Jason Clarke and Gary Oldman's showdown where he shows up and it's like they just have this whole trust sequence where Caesar's going up and he's having this heroic thing. And like Jason Clarke's choice in this is not to explain like, hey, like there's a super intelligent leader or whatever. Like he just picks up a gun and like he does a really bad job of explaining.
It
justifies a very dope cut in the movie where he's like, he's up there and he's like, who? And then it's like Caesar like rising out of the crowd and walking up, which like, don't care. Like that's dope as shit. But the when it goes to Gary Oldman just like grabbing it and then blowing it up. And then that just becomes like justification for like adding 10% to the set piece.
Yeah.
And we don't really see anybody else dying or consequences to that. I think that payoff doesn't build to the place where you'd like it to. And I think that that is where that imbalance comes from. At the same time, I'm like, yeah, we just built that whole thing up so that there'd be a cool explosion during the third act. And I'm cool with that.
I like that. Like, you know, the stakes are so dire at that moment that like he can't even explain correctly.
Yes. No, I
like,
disagree.
He's like, you can't blow this up. He's up there. And he's just like, who's up there?
Yeah.
And you can't even like, how could he even explain? You asked him to explain that. Like, how could he even,
it's like, it's the only chance for peace between two societies.
So, like Gary Oldman cannot even fathom what the fuck he's talking about. I love, you know, it's like another difference between battle. Like when they see Caesar on a fucking CCTV, they're like, oh, that's Caesar. Oh my God.
Yeah.
And this one, they hear, you know, him talk and they're just like, they don't even know that the whole thing was led by a hyper-intelligent.
Right.
That information seems to have not gotten out into the public.
Right.
Yeah.
And even when Gary Oldman hears about it, he's like, yeah, no, you didn't see that.
He's like,
Brian Cox was probably trying to tell people and it was like, no one listened to him.
Yeah. I mean, it was great that we get to get that scene of like all these human reactions to like him talking
right
when it comes, you know,
well, and say, like, and I will say that the pipeline to breaking down the walls to full enslavement of an encampment is pretty quick.
Koba had all that policy
ready to go.
You're a friend of mine, Michael Giacchino.
So
what we have, Patrick Doyle was the first one. And I think his is just like basic, serious movie action thing. And it was epic, but I don't know this. I did not read into this, but I feel like Michael Giacchino was like, I want to bring back some of the goofiness from the Goldsmith and from the original. Yeah. Because there are some cues that I was like, what? Like, they were really wacky.
I love the traveling, the kind of like yes. evil travel thing.
Well, he loves the travel. Well, he's just, what's the like, one from Lost? That, is it called just traveling?
I think it's just called traveling. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's called Take a Hike or something. Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah. Yep, I know. Yeah. Yeah.
But like, I just feel like.
For any listeners in Hawaii, get us that record.
Yeah. Yeah. I just feel like he's just so good at themes in general, like creating memorable themes or like putting the time into like creating distinctive themes for like, you know, adventure mm-hmm. or like the kind of like regal heroism of Caesar and the emotional stuff. You know, it's just like, yeah, we talked a little bit about that opening sequence, but like his score for that opening is just so somber and sad, and it just immediately sets the tone for everything. And I think like this is one of my favorite scores of his, like the ape stuff. So good.
No, your favorite score has to be the Rogue One vinyl that I got autographed.
Oh yeah, of course.
For you. Yeah. And the waited Rogue in line One, for like 10 hours.
Signed vinyl.
Yeah. From, anyways.
I do like that too. Yeah.
Just really quickly, I want to say, I do realize that I feel like I'm lobbing a lot of
No.
I just think that this movie like gets really, really close to a lot of things that would have like made it just like an absolutely kind of transcendent blockbuster in a way. And it just frustrates me a little bit that it just doesn't quite get there.
Well, and I think that you're speaking to like these movie, it's kind of has a forgotten place. Like there's a lot of greatness here and it did not catch. I mean, people like this movie. It did well. And I think that your theory of this kind of being this breaking point with Guardians in 2014, you know, it's the reason why War was not as beloved, but War kind of perfects a lot of the imperfections that this movie came forward. And those imperfections make complete sense. It's them pushing the boundaries of, you know, it's the first time that they did mocapture and Rain and like all this other stuff. And that's like, true. So some of those are technical limitations that happen with this movie. But at the time it was just so fucking ballsy to do this. And it's like, wait, the Felicity guy?
The Cloverfield guy?
Yeah, I know. Yes, I know his Cloverfield guy. But even then, like it is a technical achievement that I feel like that delivers on a thematic level that I think that is even that War doesn't even quite get to in that way, in some ways. And I think that it is that, I don't know. It's the right mix for me, but it's a very personal mix for me.
Sure. I think he deserves a lot of credit for, you know, infusing this movie with a lot of that stuff. I'm sure it was like kind of a hard battle to get a lot of that into the movie. And I really admire where he took it. I have not watched War again since theaters, but I just remember it as being, I don't know, just a lot more kind of unified in terms of what it's going for and what it gets to. Mm-hmm. You know, it's cool that he was able to do that with this franchise that occupies such a strange place in the landscape.
It's really weird. And like, I do think that it's probably one of the most of the, you know, of these three. And I don't actually even really, I don't think we know how much Kingdom is a direct, you know, extension of.
But like, I'm trying not to read.
It
much
is.
About
it is. I would say it's probably one of the most underrated trilogies that exists out there.
Yeah. Are there any Tyler's? Are there any other like points that we haven't gotten to yet before we like kind of wrap up the?
Well, if we could talk about the box office just a little.
Well,
bit.
Yeah, Justin, did you pull it up?
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
It made $710 million.
Jesus Christo.
And that's worldwide, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want to talk about the broader kind of landscape with the box office around this movie, because again, I think 2014 is just such an important crossroads in the development of where like Hollywood filmmaking and franchise filmmaking went. Because if you look at the top 10 for 2014, there was only one movie that made over $1 billion worldwide that year. Can anyone?
Was it Guardians?
No. It's a movie we covered.
What?
Transformers?
Transformers Age of Extinction.
No!
$1.1 billion.
That one right up there?
The vinyl record up on my wall?
The dinosaur one? Oh yeah. My god. That
is the hey, one. See, it was still
Tucci.
It was still that's popping right. off.
It was Tucci. It was Tucci. The touch of the Tucci.
Yeah. So that's touch.
Sorry, that's a blank check thing.
I love the Tucci. Yeah. Yeah. I just want to get that on the record. Number two is The Hobbit, Battle of the Five Armies.
Oh, no.
Is that the second or the third one?
That's the third one.
The third one. Okay. Yeah, which somehow made $960 million worldwide. Reaching back to kind of an earlier franchise, earlier period of filmmaking.
Can you imagine being Weta and being like making that and then making this in the same year? That's fucking
frame
nuts.
Rates, man.
Yeah. Frame rates.
Just real quick, I want to shout out Lindsay Ellis, the YouTuber or video essayist, did a great series on the Hobbit movies a few years back. I encourage everyone to go back and watch that. Gets a little out of what made those movies kind of go off the rails. So coming in at number three is Guardians of the Galaxy, $770 million worldwide. Now, that movie made around $300 million domestic.
Okay.
Now, this is a period where the highest grossing movie of the year at the domestic box office could top out at $300 million. Mm-hmm. Just for comparison's sake, I believe Barbie made like well over $600 million just in the domestic market last year. So you get a sense of just how much the box office has changed from over the last 10 years from looking at these numbers. Number four is Maleficent, kind of the movie that really started like the Disney live action remake juggernaut. Five, you got The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 1. Six, X-Men Days of Future Past.
Ooh,
seven, my God. Captain America the Winter Soldier. Eight, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. Nine, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And 10 is Interstellar. So just by looking at the top 10 of 2014 in terms of worldwide box office, it's a really fascinating like cross-section of these franchises that would kind of get left behind. And then also just like the properties that would define like the next decade of Hollywood. I mean, you've got Christopher Nolan, a franchise unto himself right at the bottom there. The failed Sony Spider-Man franchise, the MCU occupying two spots on the list, which by the way, Winter Soldier was kind of Marvel's attempt to do like the grimdark blockbuster.
Yeah. I'm shocked that, I mean, not really because everyone loves Guardians and Guardians is actually fun, but I'm so surprised that Winter Soldier is so much lower than Guardians because the way people talk about that movie is like, you know, it's the second coming, but so that's just really funny.
So within that, you know, you have Transformers. I mean, obviously there was a new one of those last year, right?
Better than that one.
I believe it. Like I was saying, like the Disney Maleficent kind of kicking off Disney's period of like, well, we're gonna reach back to our history and like kind of mine our animated movies for live action IP. I just find that fascinating just because the next year is when Star Wars The Force Awakens comes out and just kind of resets expectations of like how big our blockbuster movie is going to be.
Right.
That same year is, so this is the big thing. As I was saying, there was one movie in 2014 that made over $1 billion worldwide. 2015, there were 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The top five all made over $1 billion. You had Force Awakens, Jurassic World, Furious 7, Avengers Age of Ultron, and Minions. So,
and that was the peak of the box office.
And that's also the moment that really, like, kind of resets a lot of expectations and decisions that are being made in Hollywood. You know, Jurassic World is really the thing that like mints the kind of legacy sequel as that, like, this can do huge business. You know, you have the Fast and Furious.
I feel that that one is a little bit of a fluke though, because of Paul Walker's death. That was the one after.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think it would have been as high had it just been.
I mean, just look what happened to Fast.
Right.
I mean,
that's very true, but it is like, that is the movie that convinces them to like kind of extend the franchise.
Further, and
kind of build it into the juggernaut that it is now. So I don't know. I just find that fascinating. And, and it's also just like the year before Dawn in 2013, you had movies like Wolf of Wall Street and American Hustle that were like getting over $100 million worldwide. And like
adult dramas.
That type of movie is just very quickly going to fade away.
Right.
Just in.
Unless it's Christopher Nolan.
Exactly right. So I don't know. I think 2014, if you're studying kind of the history of Hollywood, like that, you can really home in on that year as this kind of tipping point in a way, which I just find really interesting.
Well, and like, this Apes and the X-Men and, you know, whatever else was Fox at the time is now all under the same Disney. So you have it all consolidating under like way less studios as well.
Yeah.
So this Kingdom will be the first one since the acquisition.
Yeah.
be interesting.
Also illustrates, like, you know, I think at the time when Dawn came out, there was still this idea of, like, you can kind of hand control of your franchise to, like, this a kind of quote-unquote auteur director. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Reeves turns in this movie and it's immediately like, oh, okay, he's got the next one. His
right.
full creative vision will be, like, unlocked there.
Yeah. Yeah.
And now with Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, it's like, okay, we're handing this off to a new director. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it feels like the IP is the star.
Edgar Wright's here. About to be fired from Ant-Man.
No, exactly right. Yeah. Fascinating time in the history of movies.
Okay, so rating?
Rating system.
I would, you know what, Eliz? How many referential buses would you give to Dawn of the Planet of the Apes?
I think last week I said 8. Yeah. But I'm just going to...
You said ape.
Ape, yes. I'm going to stay at 8 for, like, because... I know you guys were saying you like this one even better, but I think for me, I just like both of them and it's kind of the same because there is still like something. This movie's great, but I really like the other one too. And this one, there is still something I feel like that is off and it
you
might just
do plus
be
plus one for lack of James Franco.
No, I mean, I don't know because James Franco is James Franco and is inescapable, right? But
you heard it
the
here
relation,
first.
I really, really like the relationship between him and Caesar.
Yes,
and there is nothing like that in this
That's
one.
True.
Like even Jason Clarke does not get as much time or, you know, none of the humans get as good of a connection with any ape.
Hey, Jason Clarke allegedly loves his son.
In theory.
He says a few lines to indicate
I just
that.
Think there's no relationship but like between like the most interesting relationship is like between Caesar and Koba and then maybe Blue Eyes but like we don't really get to see much between Caesar and his wife. We don't get to see a lot with Carrie Russell, so for me, like, not to always be me, but I feel like it is missing like the female and also
this movie
people of color
perspective test.
Yeah, it does, definitely does not, like, you know. Yeah. Even if you consider like
if you consider Carrie Russell's whispered
and
words
Judy Greer,
to Judy Greer.
But I think they're still basically dealing with the baby and Caesar.
Sure.
Like, so it's like, whatever.
Right.
So yes, no Bechdel test, even if you consider Judy Greer human, but,
I do.
Of course. Yeah. I don't even know. What is her character's name? Like,
it's Cornelia.
I don't think they actually said it though. No, I think that's all just like IMDb gathering. Like, I don't think they talk about it.
It's probably credited as Cornelia.
Yeah. So,
it makes sense.
You get that when she said, say goodbye to these.
It makes sense since all the apes are still all together. It's the same apes.
It is interesting. Like, this is just a weird tidbit of some of the behind the scenes where like Matt Reeves like very much tried to like, no, like she needs to look feminine.
And, right. Like, let's put a little necklace.
Like, she has like longer hair or whatever. And like, and what people talk about, like, yeah, it was like one of the hardest designs to crack. And it's like, you're telling on yourself, dudes.
Right. At least they didn't go full Helen Bonham Carter.
Yeah, true.
You know. So anyways, yeah, there is still a little bit of something missing for me that I feel like the other movie had, but then I feel like this one, you know, has a lot of the action and the ape to ape drama that we didn't get as much of last time. So yeah, I'm going to stay at 8.
I'm going to give this 10.
Whoa.
I'm going to go for 10. I'm going right to 10. 10, you know, super important buses that we totally forgot about.
Yeah.
That was the most important scene in the entire
movie. Yeah.
Poor Maurice chained up in that bus.
Did we even talk about that scene? I don't know.
No, we didn't.
Other than for
like
me
a
to
whole
demand.
Giant battle sequence.
We skipped over it.
With a fucking tank and everything.
And it's a splash page to your point. It absolutely is.
I love this movie. I think it's great. I just love the immediate, like, dive into this darker tone. For me, like, I know you, Tyler, you said that the film feels a little long for you. I just felt like watching this, like, I feel like there's not even a moment wasted. I'm just like, I know there's more coming every, you know, it is a long movie. And you think watching it like, oh, wow, this still has to happen. This still has to happen. But I enjoy it the whole time. And it feels like it flows well for me. But.
Well, you know, it's interesting. If you're talking about like rhythms of movies, this is getting very into the weeds, but like 2 hours, 10 minutes is like one of the weirdest running times you can have because it's perched weirdly between like the kind of the tightness
90.
Of a 2 hour movie or like a 90 minute movie and like just the kind of breathing space of like a 2.5 hour movie. And I just feel like often it serves neither master well, you know, because it's not quite tight enough and it doesn't have quite enough room to breathe.
I think that is fair. Factual.
That's fair. I mean, there are exceptions that prove the rule. Uncut Gems is like 215, right. So, you know.
I don't know. Just for me, like, this is all Caesar's movie. I couldn't care less about the humans too much. Even during the movie, I was like, I want to hate them so much. But, like, I do think, like, even just that one scene, even with Gary Oldman crying about his kids, is like pretty powerful, and goes like, okay, fine. I don't totally hate the humans. Mm-hmm. I get where they're coming from. They have lost a lot. Mm-hmm. I would probably cry. And that's a pretty well done scene. It's like, it communicates your point in a short emotional moment. I just think it's great. The action's great. Michael Giacchino on board. I love him. Love this movie. Very strong. Andy Serkis is the best.
Yes. I'm also going to go 10 referential buses. I think that all of Tyler's insights in the movie are entirely thoughtful and correct and not any way detracting from my enjoyment from this film.
that's good.
And I think that it is, I think that for me, it is a little bit of that clunkiness. It's a little bit of the boldness that maybe we're lingering too much on the apes. Maybe we're leaning too much into the technology. Maybe there's so much timidness and maybe there's a little bit more humanity in it because of that. But I really love the idea that I think this movie accurately captures the social inertia that leads to mutual assured destruction. And I think that is the thing that this franchise has captured the imagination of everybody with to begin with. Like, that is that image of the Empire, of the Statue of Liberty. And I think that having the cinematic patience to dive into the emotions of that story and to go into people that were desperately trying to make it not happen and have it happen anyway is, and I do think that this movie does something very clear where it's like, no matter what happens now, that's the path that we're on. Like, this is the only moment where perhaps, you know, there could have been peace between these two people. And it's like that, it sends humanity on the path to enslavement. It sends the world, like, the world hasn't been blown up at this point, right? And it kind of is this opera of best intentions that results in destruction. And there's something really incredible about that to me, especially when you're doing it with, like, computer monkeys.
Don't say monkeys. It's offensive.
The ending is great, where you're just like, Caesar is there. He accepts what's coming. And then we just, like, zoom in on his eyes.
Well,
like,
the movie starts on his eyes and ends on his eyes. Yeah.
This is it. The path is before him.
Yeah.
It's a fun movie to, like, in the middle of it, like, take a step back and think about, like, what you're actually looking at.
Yeah.
Yes. What am I seeing right now? All right, I'm seeing an ape have a, like, conversation with a human being about, like, restarting a hydroelectric dam.
Oh, really quick. I think one thing I didn't talk about is that, like, them riding horses and simultaneously riding horses in mocap is one of the most fucking crazy things in the world. And there's a still that I remember from a behind the scenes that I watched, like, way back when this came out, of all of the actors playing apes and mocap sitting on a soundstage riding, like, sitting on top of ladders, like, pretending to ride on top of them, because, like, you can do one, you can do two, but, like, doing, like, eight of them, and they would do eight of them, and they try to do it clean plate, and they'd have to train the horses. Yeah. It's nuts. Anyway.
Tyler Aquilina, what's your score for this one? It's out of 10.
Okay, yes. Solid 7, I would say. I really, again, I cannot stress how much that I admire all the ideas and all the things this movie is shooting for. I really love the big swings that Reeves takes with this one. And just, if anything, I just wish they were bigger. And I just feel that, again, it gets, like, really, really close, but doesn't quite reach the heights for me. But I do think he would reach a lot of those heights in War. So, you know, maybe he just needed this one to kind of work out the kinks a little bit.
Yeah.
All right, fair. Well, as we talked about, this one was super successful at the box office. Audiences loved it. And
shocking to me.
Hey, I don't know. 2017, here comes War for the Planet of the Apes. That's the 3 years. That's the next one,
I have seen this movie. I remember there's a lot of snow and there's a little girl, and that's pretty much all I remember.
You may be surprised how much of the movie is spent with Caesar like nailed to the cross.
Yeah.
That doesn't surprise me at all because he already is Jesus. Yeah.
It's like, well, this is the one where he becomes both ape Jesus and ape Moses.
Yeah.
Oh, Moses too. Okay.
Yes, that's right. All right, sweet. Well, we'll be talking about that next week. But in the meantime, Tyler Aquilino, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you for having me. This was great.
Yeah, super
Where
fun.
Can people find your work?
You can read my work at variety.com/VIP. That is a data-driven subscriber tier of Variety, where we look at and dive deeper into the trends fueling the media and tech business. For instance, I just did a big report about the end of peak TV, where I, like so many of us, attempt to make sense of this very strange time in Hollywood history. Yeah. So check that out, variety.com/VIP.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, thanks so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
All right, Eliz, where can people reach out?
Email us, sequelrights@gmail.com, or social media on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, at Sequel Rights. And also don't forget to check out like a couple of the video interviews that we've done recently with some of the apes guys showing off both the mocap side and the older makeup side.
Yeah, absolutely. Those videos are incredible and you should rate and review the podcast wherever you're listening and then hop on whatever social you have to go share those videos wherever you can. It will help other people find this. I'm sure everybody's just itching to know the whole story before they go see Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. We're shorter than the movies, it turns out. So yeah, sometimes, right. Maybe.
Sometimes.
All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of this episode. And as we like to do now, you may have missed this earlier, but we have started including these amazing, hilarious, hopefully.
If you do say so yourself, yeah.
You know, they're totally amazing. These AI-generated songs from Suno AI, so that we're not using as much copyrighted music on the show. And this week, the song is titled Apes Got Guns.
Perfect.
And it's in the style of aggressive rap. These guys have heard it here already. You guys are going to hear it for the first time. We hope you guys enjoy this song about Gary Oldman. It's going to be great. All right. Enjoy the song here. We'll see you guys next week for War for the Planet of the Apes.
In the midst of chaos, in the heat of the fray, Gary Oldman scheming in his own wicked way. But little does he know that apes have got a surprise. They're armed to the teeth, ready to rise. Holy shit, apes got guns. What do we do now that these apes got guns? I'm Gary Oldman, and I've got guns too. Don't step to me, you don't know what I'll do. Old man shouting orders with rage in his eyes, but the apes are advancing, catching him by surprise. He pulls out his weapon thinking he's got the mic, but the apes are relentless, ready for the fight. Ready for the fight. Holy shit, apes got guns. What do we do now that these apes got guns? I'm Gary Oldman, and I've got guns too. Don't step to me, you don't know what I'll do. Bullets flying, chaos ensues. Oldman's trapped with nothing to lose. He pushes the button with a trembling hand, but little does he know it's all gone unplanned. Boom goes the dynamite, Oldman's blown away. In a cloud of smoke, he needs his dismay. The apes stand victorious with guns in their paws, while old man's downfall echoes through the halls. Holy shit, apes got guns. What do we do now that these apes got guns? I'm Gary Oldman, and I've got guns too. But it talks to me, you don't know what I'll do. Oh, hey, hey. Holy shit, apes got guns. What do we do now that these apes got guns? I'm Gary Oldman, and I've got guns too. But, holy shit, I still can't believe they had guns. They were riding horses, shooting off guns with the banner, dual wielding guns against Gary Oldman. Gary thought that was scary and blew himself to kingdom come.